Morning, everyone. I want to start by thanking the organizers for organizing this wonderful conference series again and for asking me to speak at it. What I want to talk to you about today is maybe we'll describe as the hunt for non-classical states in macroscopic mechanical oscillators in my lab. And there was supposed to be sort of a picture of a little cat here and someone hunting it. And clearly, this is essentially the problem that we have at the moment. So I should start by acknowledging the people involved in the work. PhD student who's been doing, who's really been leading in the lab this project is George Brawley. And he's working with Michael Vanner, who's a postdoc who joined my group from Mark Zasselmeyer's group about a year ago. And we're collaborating, let me see if this works, with Anya and Sylvain from DTU, who provide us with strings that we use in the experiments, nanostrings. So the kind of thing we really want to do is something like this. This is a non-classical state of motion of an ion in an ion trap from Dave Weiland's group. It's a single phonon Fock state. And this was reported about 2 decades ago, so you might wonder why are you still worrying about this sort of thing. It's a done deal. And what I'd like to argue is that there's really significant differences between a non-classical state of motion of a single ion and a non-classical state of motion of some large, you know, for example, a crystal of 10 to the 16 strongly coupled atoms like you get in a mechanical oscillator. And some of those differences are the one which is very close to my heart and also very, very challenging to realize is is that you can push into a regime where you can test fundamental physics. You can test how non-standard models of decoherence in quantum mechanics arise. How does the classical world come about from the quantum world? And maybe even, how does general relativity play out? How does that interact with quantum mechanics? Something else that I think is very nice is that if you've got a system of 10 to the 16 atoms all coupled together like this, then you can engineer nonlinearities in that system by changing the structure, right? It's very hard to do. It's much harder to do with an ion or even with nonlinear optics. So you can really control what nonlinearities are exhibited by the structure and how strong they are. And so that leads you to some interesting experiments in quantum mechanics with nonlinearities, with maybe higher order nonlinearities. And the other thing I like is that mechanical oscillators are widely used in applications as sensors, as clocks, as things like this. And if we can learn how to control them at a quantum level, then hopefully we can make some of those applications better. And you could even imagine applications in quantum information. Mechanical oscillators are nice because, one, they can ring for a very long time, so you can imagine a memory, and second, they interact via forces with microwaves, with light, with atoms, with ions. So you can use them to transfer quantum information from one type of quantum system to another. Okay, so I wanted to start by just reminding everyone of, what the requirements of achieving some sort of quantum state of a mechanical oscillator are. And you can see this very clearly just by looking at the variance of the motion of some oscillator, right? It has two components. There's a zero-point motion component and a thermal component. So the first thing you need is you need this component to dominate this component, right? And that essentially means that you need h bar omega, the energy of a phonon, to be larger than kT. And that tells you the temperatures that you're typically going to have to work with are in the millikelvin to microkelvin, so very low temperatures. The second thing you're going to need is you need to be able to see the motion of the oscillator. In other words, you need to be able to see this. And you can see as oscillators get larger, the mass gets smaller, so this becomes harder. And if you just plug in some rough numbers, you come out with the idea that you need to be able to resolve motion down to maybe a femtometer, and you need to do that in a time scale that's short compared to the time one phonon is going to enter the oscillator. So this is a hard challenge. But there's been an enormous amount of progress in the field to achieve both of these things. It turns out if you achieve this challenge, it helps you achieve this one, because you can use cooling techniques, laser cooling or measurement-based cooling, to get to low temperatures. And there are two approaches people take. I'm sorry if this is all very slow and tutorial-like for some of you, but there it is. One is electromechanics, and the other is optomechanics. So electromechanics, you have some sort of resonant circuit, a capacitor coupled to an inductor, and then one of the capacitor plates might vibrate, and that changes the resonance of the circuit. In optomechanics, you have a cavity or an interferometer or maybe just a very tightly focused laser beam interacting with your mechanical oscillator and picking up a phase shift or a frequency shift. And so the two problems I just listed have really been solved, at least in some systems now. And here are some examples. So this is some beautiful work from Conrad Leonard's group, where he showed that you could generate entanglement between a microwave field and mechanical oscillator. This is Cindy Riegel's work showing that looking at a mechanical oscillator causes back action, quantum back action. And this is the result from Oscar Painter's group, where he's generating quantum squeezing. And these aren't supposed to be represented. You know, they're just representative. They're not supposed to be all-inclusive. And another result from Tobias Kippenberg. But what I'd like to emphasize here is that all of these results are based on the linear optomechanical Hamiltonian that I'm going to talk a bit about more later. Right? So you can only ever produce Gaussian states. You can produce a Gaussian entangled state, but you can't produce a state with Wigner negativity. Right? So it turns out there's another requirement that isn't talked about quite as much, but people are very aware of in the field, and that is you need access to some sort of nonlinearity that gives you this Wigner negativity, right? And this is well known in quantum optics. So for example, in cavity QED, you use an atom, which is a two-level system, to induce a nonlinearity that gives you Fock states or some other sort of non-classical state of light. And that's been extended into superconducting circuit type systems. So people in the field are starting to apply these sorts of ideas. So take some hybrid optomechanical system that involves a mechanical oscillator and some other quantum system to produce nonlinearities that allow you to make non-classical states. This is one example from Clellan's group, where he's coupling some vibrational mode of a piezoelectric material to a superconducting qubit. Another example from Olivier Arcizet's group, where he has a rod of gallium arsenide, and he has some quantum dots in it. And as the rod vibrates, it changes the stress on the quantum dots, and then that changes their frequency. So again, you're coupling your mechanical oscillator is some two-level system, right? But you can also, this is a really promising approach, but it's also quite hard. You can also get nonlinearities from controlling the environment of the mechanical oscillator. So one example from my group is that you could use an electric field that's local near the mechanical oscillator to control the Hamiltonian of the mechanical oscillator itself and get a nonlinearity from that. But maybe a much more well-known example, and this is really where this whole thing is going, is not that, is this, is something called the membrane in the middle scheme that Jack Harris came up with, which is not this. This is a normal optomechanical system where I have a mechanical oscillator coupled to a cavity. The mechanical oscillator shifts. It changes the resonance frequency of the cavity through this Hamiltonian. So Jack's idea was, well, what if I had a two-mirror cavity and I had the oscillator in the middle of the cavity? Now, depending on where I put the oscillator, I either get a linear electric field gradient or I get a quadratic gradient. And if I arrange it so I have the quadratic gradient, then my Hamiltonian goes from being one which is linear in x to one that's quadratic in x. Yeah. So now I have some nonlinear Hamiltonian, and it turns out that you can make phonon Fock states and phonon Schrodinger cat states with this sort of Hamiltonian. All right. But this, so here's an interesting point. If you look at this, this is already a nonlinear Hamiltonian, right? So you've got three operators. It's nonlinear. So where does that nonlinearity go? Why did all those experiments I talked about, why did they have a linear interaction? Well, it's because we linearize a dagger a, right, and we drop the product term, and we make that, so we replace a dagger a with some coherent amplitude times the amplitude quadrature of the laser, and then the normal optomechanical Hamiltonian becomes linear. The quadratic one stays nonlinear. This is more interesting somehow than this. Yeah. But there's been a lot of thought about how you'd take advantage of this full Hamiltonian, particularly in the area of single photon optomechanics. If you can get to a regime where one photon matters, then you can't do the linearization anymore, right? Right, where am I? So the problem is that you need really strong interactions to do that, right? You don't get this boost that I had here, this alpha anymore, which is square root of the number of photons in the cavity. So it turns out Michael Vanner, who was the postdoc doing this work prior to coming to my group, had this very, very nice idea to take advantage of the nonlinearity of the Hamiltonian without requiring that you're in the ultra, in the single photon strong coupling regime. And the essential idea is very, very simple. And I'll explain it as I go. But the idea is that instead of measuring the phase quadrature of light, which is what you normally do in an optomechanical system, because if the mirror moves, it changes the phase of the light. So I need to measure the phase if I want to learn something about the position of the mirror. Instead of doing that, I measure the amplitude quadrature of the optical field, which you kind of think would carry no information. It turns out it does, and I'll go through it. But what happens is that you get an effective conditional Hamiltonian, including that measurement, which now looks exactly the same as the Hamiltonian, the x squared Hamiltonian, except that this mu naught, this sort of zero, this single photon quadratic coupling rate, is replaced with g naught squared, the linear single photon coupling rate, divided by kappa, the optical decay rate. And this turns out to be a much, much larger number than this. For a Fabry-Perot, it's larger by a factor of the finesse of the cavity. So you really get a huge boost in the strength of coupling over this. And you also get a lot more flexibility because you can choose any optomechanical system you like. It doesn't have to have some x squared, some parabolic dependence of electric field on position. So just to understand how this works, it's worth thinking about what the optical field looks like when you reflect it off a cavity optomechanical system. So I've got input, I'm reflecting the field off, and I'm going to do some Homodyne measurement, right? And if I didn't have the cavity at all, I would just get some phasor with some noise, right? But now, in the linearized approximation, what does this mirror do if it's got some noise on it, which is due to, either vacuum noise or thermal noise? Then that puts a noise onto the phase quadrature of the light, and it makes it blurred out a bit, right? But what's really going on is it's actually a phase noise that you're adding. So it doesn't look like this. It looks like this. It's curved, right? So now if I think about the output of my Homodyne, right, normally you're going to sit here where you've got a linear response to a phase shift on the light. But instead I'm going to sit here where I'm on the amplitude quadrature, and what you can see is immediately I've got a quadratic response, right? I get information which is now quadratic in x. And what that does is, if let's say I got a value up here, it tells me the absolute value of the phase shift on the light, but it doesn't tell me the sign. And that means that I end up with two possible regions where the phase of the light could be, and ultimately that I end up with two possible regions of phase space where the mechanical oscillator can be. So I can collapse the mechanical oscillator into a non-classical state, into a Schrodinger cat-like state. And this is a figure from Michael's paper that shows you can get Wigner negativity in those sorts of states. So there's one thing that I found very strange about this whole idea when Michael first mentioned it to me, and that was that, okay, so I'm making a measurement which is clearly proportional to x squared, but the interaction is still linear, right? So I'm still driving with shot noise on the amplitude quadrature of the laser, the mechanical oscillator, and I would have thought that that would completely destroy any quantum state you might want to prepare. It turns out the beautiful thing is by measuring the amplitude quadrature of the light, you know exactly what that drive is, and you can erase it off, right? So if you make a perfect measurement, then you can erase the first order interaction between light and mechanical oscillator and leave yourself only with the second order. And I sort of think about this like linear optics quantum computing, right? Where here, I mean, you have a nonlinear measurement which makes the computation possible. In our case, we have a measurement which, well, I guess it effectively increases the order of the nonlinearity because it allows you to remove the otherwise dominating type of nonlinearity. So this is the idea. We set about doing the experiment. This is what the experiment looks like. So we have a laser. We split it. We have a homodyne detector, local oscillator. And then we have a signal beam that goes through the cavity optomechanical system and then into the homodyne. The particular cavity optomechanical system we choose is an evanescent optomechanical system, as first demonstrated in the Kippenberg group. This is a picture from one of his earlier papers, where he takes a beam that's about 20 microns long and he couples it evanescently to a toroid. This toroid has an optical mode that decays exponentially outside it. You put the beam into the mode and the toroid feels it. And its resonance frequencies become sensitive to the position of the oscillator. So in our case, what we're doing is quite similar. We're just using a very different sort of beam. We're using a nanostring, which is extremely long. So about half a millimeter long and about 50 nanometers thick. And what that gives us is a low resonance frequency and a very high Q. So we have devices in the lab which have Qs of about 5 by 10 to the 6. In this particular case, the Q of the mechanical oscillator is more like 10 to the 5, 2 by 10 to the 5. And it's coupled to a microsphere resonator. Okay, and it all sits within a vacuum chamber with some positioning stages that allow us to push the string into the evanescent field. If we lock the homodyne on the phase quadrature of light, that gives you linear information about the mechanical position, and this is the kind of thing we see. So this is the power spectrum on the light. So I'm taking the output of the homodyne and I'm Fourier transforming it, and this is frequency centered around the mechanical resonance frequency, and you see a very sharp spike. This is a shot noise level. This is just a tail of the Lorentzian. So we have extremely good signal to noise, something like 5. It's about 90 dB in power, so it's very, very high, and a very sharp resonance, so that's good. And what I'm showing you here, you can kind of forget about for the moment, but this is the same spectrum, but at twice the mechanical resonance frequency. Okay, so from that measurement, and knowing that we put something like 20,000 photons in the cavity, we can work out the optomechanical coupling rate. The vacuum coupling rate, or single photon coupling rate, is around 75 hertz, which is not the best. It's okay, it's not the best. And the coherent amplitude boosted coupling rate is around 12 kilohertz. The vacuum coupling rate allows us to estimate what this quadratic coupling rate is going to be. And that turns out to be 220 microhertz. So that's quite small. to justify this, I'd make a few observations. The first is the coupling rate you care. So what you really care about is this rate boosted by the square root of the number of photons, so by a factor of, you know, a bit over 100. And you want to compare that to the geometric mean. Depending on what you want to do, one thing you might want to compare it to is the geometric mean of the decay rate of the cavity and the decay rate of the mechanical oscillator, which in our case might be around a kilohertz. So we're comparing something that might be 40 millihertz to about a kilohertz. Yeah, so we're pretty far off being able to do something interesting from a quantum perspective with this existing device. But what I would say is that if I compare it to the best membrane in the middle scheme, it's about an order of magnitude better. And because this coupling rate scales as G0 squared, we can readily improve it. So in fact, we've seen G0s with the same devices which are two orders of magnitude larger. We just didn't use them for these experiments for technical reasons. So that would give you four orders of magnitude in this coupling rate. And we've also seen had better optical cues. So there are ways where we can get into actually what is a interesting regime from a quantum perspective. The other thing I would mention is that if you look at the best linear optomechanical coupling rates, which are achieved in photonic crystals, then you get a G0 squared on kappa of around 160 hertz, right? Which multiplied by 100 or so, depending on how many photons you can get into your cavity, becomes very interesting, I think. So this is a scheme that has real potential to allow you to produce non-classical states of mechanical oscillator. All right, so this is all from just the phase quadrature measurement. What we're really interested in is an amplitude quadrature measurement, which will give us x squared information. Now, if you think about x squared, if the mechanical oscillator is basically oscillating like sine omega t, right, and I square it, I don't expect to see a signal anymore at omega. I expect to see a signal at DC and a signal at 2 omega. Right, that's why this is here. And indeed, that's what you see. So if I lock to the amplitude quadrature in the Homodyne, I suppress the linear information about the position of the mechanical oscillator by something like, in power, about 50 dB. That's really important, right? Because if you want to produce a Schrodinger cat state that's either here or here, and you've got linear information, there's a problem. Yeah, it's going to tell you which side you're on. And I get this big spike at twice the mechanical resonance frequency, which is giving me x squared information. Okay, so to understand the significance of this, it's worth thinking in the time domain, I think. So if I start out with a mechanical oscillator that's, say, thermal, or it could be in a vacuum state, so this is supposed to be phase space and a big blob, right? And I linearly measure it, then I'll get, as a function of time, some series of data points and some oscillation, like a sine, and I can do some estimation, right, based on this data, and I can fit out what I think the position of the oscillator is in phase space, right, getting some phase angle and some amplitude. Yep. And what that allows you to do is effectively cool the oscillator. Right? You've localized it. You've cooled it. If instead I use the x squared information, then x squared is never below zero, and it oscillates twice as fast. Right? But I can still do estimation, figure out what the phase is, and then I can figure out a parameter that looks like the amplitude squared. But I don't know if the amplitude is positive or negative. That's really the key. So now, what I'm doing is cooling the oscillator, kind of like in the linear measurement case, but I'm cooling it into a bimodal state, which one would hope might be a Schrodinger cat state, but I'm going to tell you right now is not in our case. Right? So this is the idea. So to verify this, we did some experiments, and the first experiment was just to check that indeed, you know, this height is the square of the height of the linear measurement. So we locked the Homodyne at 45 degrees so we could get a linear and quadratic measurement simultaneously, and we just recorded the data and plotted it. And indeed what you see is you get this very nice parabolic dependence of the x squared measurement on the x measurement. So that's good. And the second thing we did was to condition a bimodal state. And it's a classical bimodal state. There's nothing quantum about it. But the process that we use could be applied if you had better coupling strengths to produce a quantum state. So the way this works is that we just wait until the x squared measurement gives us a phase and an amplitude squared that we're happy with, and then we verify what, and that should produce. So obviously this is, you know, continuously producing states with different separations and different angles. We're just going to wait until we get the right one, and then we're going to verify with a linear measurement that indeed we did condition this non-Gaussian state. And what you can see is it works very nicely. So we can produce bimodal distributions, thermal distributions of a mechanical oscillator with very large separations and very clear bimodality. And what I would say, I'm not sure if I said this before, but one thing I would say here is that, as far as I'm aware, these are the first measurements in cavity optomechanical systems that required the full Hamiltonian to explain, not just the linearized version of the Hamiltonian. So I think that's quite nice. So that's really all I had to say about this. How am I doing for time? Should I?
Concluding question.
So okay, so I'll carry on.
Yeah.
Okay. So I discovered I had a bit more time than I thought, so that's good. It means I can tell you about some other experiments we're doing that are, I'll call them exotic. I don't understand them fully yet, but I think they're kind of neat. So I hope you like them. So we're doing these quantum optomechanics experiments, and we started doing some with superfluids in the last 9 months or so. And the people involved in this are Dave, who's a postdoc, and Glenn, who's a PhD student. Owen, who's been doing a lot of the fabrication, and Jing Lu, who's a collaborator doing theory. So the idea was first proposed of these sorts of superfluid optomechanical systems was first proposed by Keith Schwab last year. His idea was basically you have a bucket of superfluid. It's about 5 centimeters in diameter. And the bucket is a microwave resonator. And the superfluid has these sort of pressure waves inside it, which change the resonance frequencies of the microwave resonator. So this was the idea. And one of the very nice things about this sort of device is that as you cool the superfluid down, its viscosity goes towards zero. And that means you get very, very high mechanical Qs, right? Which is good for quantum optomechanics. It's also good for precision sensing. I think there are a lot of reasons why superfluids are interesting for quantum optomechanics. So there's just the fact that it's a good mechanical oscillator, but also it's a quantum fluid, right? And it has quantized vortices, which are interesting. It's well known that, I mean, for many years people have tried to do precision sensing with superfluids, with systems, right? And they're a nice sensor in principle because of the low viscosity and because vortices, quantized vortices, allow you to calibrate, for example, a gyroscope in an absolute way. But they've really been limited, and I think that the main thing that's limited them is readout. How well can you measure the motion of the superfluid? And that's something that cavity optomechanics resolves. And the third thing I think is really interesting about superfluids is it turns out that, you know, we have a microscopic model which is basically intractable because there are such strong interactions between the atoms in a superfluid. And we have a macroscopic phenomenological model, Landau's model, they still don't connect, right? And we still don't really understand the microscopics of superfluids. And part of the reason is we just can't see them at a microscopic level very well. So this was Keith's idea, and one disadvantage of it, in my opinion, is that it's very large, right? 5 centimeters is a very large mechanical oscillator. It's high mass. It makes it hard to do anything quantum with it. So we wanted to do superfluid optomechanics with a toroid, so much smaller. about, what is it, 60 micron compared to 50 centimeters. So, well, look it out. And so toroids are nice because you get very good precision in the readout of the circumference of the device. But the problem is, how do you get a superfluid into the circumference of the device? How do you get it into the evanescent field of the device, right? This is not trivial. But it turns out there's a really nice solution. I'm going to play a movie if it works. So, this movie... So I'll let him sort of jabber away. Okay. So what he's got is a glass cup with helium in it, and he's cooling it down below the superfluid transition, right? And once you get below the superfluid transition, you start to see these drips coming off it. And you at least for me, you initially think what's happening is that it's finding a way through the glass. But it's not. What's actually happening is that it's almost zero viscosity fluid. It's getting sucked up by van der Waals force around the sides, and it's forming a sort of 10 nanometer film and ending up dripping off, right? This is in real time, so you can imagine how fast the flow rate of a 10 nanometer film is to get drips that big. It flows very fast. So the thought was, and it turns out that these films sustain waves. It's exactly like waves, water waves on the ocean, right? In the ocean case, gravity is the restoring force. Here, van der Waals force is the restoring force. So the thought was, we cool the toroid down in a helium-4 environment, the helium liquefies, and then it just coats everything, and maybe we can see some vibrations, right? And so we set up an experiment. I won't talk about it too much because I don't have an awful lot of time, but it's basically the same experiment as what I talked about previously. It's just in a cryostat, a helium-3 cryostat, which allows us to cool down to about 600 millikelvin. And the thought is, we start out at high temperature, but we're at, you know, this pressure here, whatever that is, 10 to the minus 4 bar. When we hit about 1 Kelvin, we should see a film forming, and hopefully we'll see some interesting physics, right? And this is what we see. This is, we're sweeping the frequency of a laser through the resonance of the toroid, so light's being absorbed here. This is at 300 Kelvin. When we hit 1 Kelvin, this happens. Yeah. And when we go lower, this happens, and then all hell breaks loose. It's very very complicated. And it turns out what's happening is that where the light is, there's a dynamical back action between a superfluid mode on the film and the light inside the cavity, which drives the motion of the superfluid on this side of resonance and cools it on this side of resonance. And we can test this by sitting here and looking at the phase noise on the laser that comes out of the system, and we indeed see all these spikes, which have a Lorentzian shape, exactly what you expect for a mechanical mode of a superfluid. And I didn't really appreciate this at the time, but as far as I can tell, no measurements have been made in the 100-year history of superfluids which have resolved the thermal motion of an individual mode of a superfluid. So as far as I can tell, this is the first such measurement. And it's really important because in the theory of superfluids, you have these strong interactions between modes, between Boglyubov modes, that cause correlations and end up meaning that you can't cool to the single particle ground state of the superfluid. And you'd expect those correlations to exhibit themselves as a correlation between the noise on this mode and some other mode. So we can start to probe superfluid physics in a way that hasn't been possible before. So, we wanted to check that these were really superfluid modes, and we did a whole lot of experiments, and I'm not going to go through them, but we convinced ourselves, because it turns out that the frequency of the mode you can predict very well based on the thickness of the film, and you can change the thickness of the film using pressure or temperature, and you get, you know, really good agreement between what you'd expect and what you see. So we're convinced these are really superfluid modes. The other thing that we can immediately do, in principle, although it's a bit gnarly, now that we can see the thermal motion of a superfluid, is we can do thermometry on it, right? We can ask, what is the temperature of the mode? And it's completely, to me, it's completely not obvious what the answer should be. Because, for one, so you have this film, and it's part normal fluid, part superfluid, right? So you might think it may or may not be in thermodynamic equilibrium with the bath, let's say it is, right? Even if it is, the normal fluid component of a thin film can't vibrate because it's viscously damped, right? So any vibration you see is only the superfluid part, which is supposed to have zero entropy, and therefore maybe you'd expect it to be at zero temperature if you're just probing that part of the film, right? That goes against the general consensus in the superfluid community, by the way. And the other thing that you might be aware of is experiments where you take a tub of superfluid and drill a hole, and a very small hole, and you measure the temperature of the stuff that comes out the hole. What you find is the temperature is much, much lower than the temperature of the bath. And the reason is only the superfluid component can flow through the hole. So there are things that happen in superfluids which allow you to have temperatures which are very cold. So we wanted to test this, and we developed a way to do this, and it's not 100% finished yet, but the conclusion seems to be, I'm just going to run through it all, that the temperature of the superfluid is around 150 microkelvins, or about 10 phonons, when the temperature of the bath is about 600 millikelvin. So you have this intrinsically cold optomechanical system, which turns out to have very strong coupling. So the coupling between light and the superfluid mode is about 10 orders of magnitude stronger than in Keith Schwab's experiments that I talked about earlier. So that'll probably do it. We can laser cool and heat and do those sorts of things too. So thank you.
Thanks, Warwick. You've got plenty of time for questions. So,
according to Michael.
So energetically, where are the superfluid modes compared to the mechanical modes of the...
Good question. So I think the general question you're asking is, do I have to worry about the mechanical modes of...
Well, are they well separated, yeah.
Yeah. So it turns out there are two reasons I don't have to worry about them. The first reason is they're well separated. Turns out the superfluid modes have frequencies going from about a kilohertz to, we've seen, up to a few hundred megahertz, right? Depending on the exact mode. The toroid modes start at about 5 megahertz, and the mode that I've been showing you is about 100 kilohertz. So they're separated. But it turns out that the optomechanical coupling to the superfluid is so much stronger than to the toroid modes, about 3 orders of magnitude stronger, that we just don't have to worry about the mechanical modes of the toroid at all. They just don't feature in the thing.
Well, maybe I'll ask you a question about to clarify what. How do you know that you're just seeing a single mode of the superfluid?
Okay. So, right. I guess. So you're thinking there may be many degenerate modes.
Yes.
So I guess in principle that's possible. We do console models that tell us what the modes should be, and they kind of match, and they don't predict that there should be other modes around.
The
other thing is that as you change temperature, the thickness of the film changes, and so the modes sort of shift around. And so you see modes crossing each other, but we never see modes sort of separating. Or there's no evidence, we've seen no evidence that there are other, that there are many degenerate. Okay.
So you really have a pretty good understanding of the system.
Well, we have a pretty good, really basic understanding, but anything really...
Quantum-y,
it's... Yeah, I didn't mention, but there's also a very strong Duffing nonlinearity in this superfluid. So we put, if an amplitude modulation that drives its motion, and we put less than one photon in that amplitude modulation, it's enough to shift the mode of the frequency of the mechanical mode of the superfluid by more than the line width. So in
one
principle,
photon in your cavity.
Yeah. So we have to be very careful that we don't use too many photons, because you get these nonlinearities, which I think are going to be very nice, but right now are just pain. So, yeah.
So I have two questions. One about the first one, about the second part. Question about the first part is, how robust is the CAT state preparation scheme to detect your inefficiency?
Yeah.
And the second one is, for this, in our fridge breaks occasionally and we get superfluid leaks.
Yeah.
And we can see the effect of those, that that mass now on our mechanical oscillators.
Yeah.
And it's by no means constant in time. It fluctuates all the time. And this is somewhat related to Howard's question. So how constant is the mass in your fluid?
Okay, so the first question. So you're extremely sensitive to any leakage of linear information about the state, obviously, right? And one way you can leak linear information is if you've got poor detection efficiency.
Yeah.
Another way is if you just if your homodyne is locked on the wrong quadrature. Yeah. So. Yeah. So what should I say?
Not very.
So there's two different aspects here, right? One thing I think is very interesting is that. There's not a problem. One thing I think is very interesting is if you'd think that if you detected linear information that would be a problem, right? But it turns out that's not a problem in principle, because at least, you know, one way you can avoid that is you keep measuring and you've got this linear record and an x squared record, and you wait until the linear record is zero. And when the linear record is zero, it doesn't tell you anything about which side the state is on, and it turns out there's no decoherence. So you can get rid of that sort of problem. So if I couldn't lock the homodyne quite right, that's a problem I can get rid of. Efficiency issues are another question altogether, and I think that's going to be a very hard problem to get around. Yeah.
Yeah. The mass question?
Oh, yes, that's right. I'll add one more comment about decoherence. So there's another decoherence channel you didn't talk about while I'm confessing, and that is that I told you that there's x squared information at twice the mechanical resonance frequency, but there's also x squared information at zero frequency. We can't access the zero frequency stuff because there's all sorts of technical noise. So you're throwing away some x squared information, right? But this is an interesting decoherence channel. It's a nonlinear decoherence channel. Yeah? And it turns out that changes the state you get out, but it doesn't wash away, at least for some states, like a Schrodinger cat state, it doesn't wash away negativity. It sort of blurs the state rather than killing it. So that's, I found that quite kind of interesting. So the mass, so we have real problems with mass changes. Yeah? So each one of these traces, this sort of power spectra I showed you, the frequency is drifting around all over the place, and we have so we maybe have 1 second to make a measurement, and then it'll be somewhere else, right? I think we can deal with that right now, because our cryostat, we can only get to 600 millikelvin, and as the temperature fluctuates, you get changes in the amount of superfluid and changes in the thickness. If we could get to 300 millikelvin, which is where we should be able to get to, then you'll saturate this. All of the helium will be liquid, and it should all become much, much more stable. If I was, you know, and I also suggest that because we have this Duffing instability, we can tune the frequency of the modes as well. So you might imagine having some active control over the frequency. But there's definitely an issue there as well. Thanks for telling everyone that.
Time for another question?
So how are you planning to probe your Schrodinger cat when you say it will have more pole than actually make, rather than a bimodal thing?
How do we probe it? So it turns out probing is not a problem. Probing is not a problem because to probe it, you need a linear measurement, right? And in order to generate the Schrodinger cat, you need such a strong interaction that your linear measurement is just going to be fantastic. When you lock to the phase quadrature, you're going to have extremely good precision. So just do tomography with locking on the phase quadrature should be completely fine. Yeah.
So you switch the quadrature you measure.
Yeah. But I mean, the real problem is getting strong enough nonlinear coupling.
So opposed to full tomography, some kind of interference is not.
You could do that as well, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, you could probably come up with some interference-based scheme as well. I like the I like tomography because it's sort of a direct verification of what the state is. Yeah.
And on those three notes, let's thank Warwick again.